The Airplane Geeks podcast is proudly sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 209 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I have a couple of co-hosts with me on Skype. First is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Greetings from Philadelphia, where we have a sultry, steamy night with no air conditioning because I got yelled at too many times for buzzing in the background. So we're sweating it out here in Philadelphia.
When you said sultry, steamy, I thought you were going to start talking about your wife.
Okay, we're going to move on now.
Oh, sorry. Also with us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had to laugh at that. Wouldn't you rather talk about your bride than us? I mean, you know, God knows. I mean, we don't want those pictures of you two out on the internet like the last time. We're not going to let that happen. No, listen. It's nice to be back. I still haven't quite recovered from AirVenture, but 103-degree heat kind of does that to you.
Yeah, wow. And we also have sort of a special guest co-host, and that's Phil Derner from NYCAviation.com. Hey, Phil.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Hey, I understand you've got some kind of new employment gig going on. Is that right?
I do. I'm still an employed man. Even with the website, and I just got a dispatch gig with a major airline now. I was working for 6 years with North American Airlines, where I had several positions during my time there, ending as a dispatcher. And now I have a dispatch with a new airline, which I won't mention the company, but it's a great company. I'm very excited to be with them, and I'm enjoying it. It's a fun gig, and I'm pretty excited.
That's great. You know, maybe we should build a whole episode around that and learn more about what the dispatching job is like. We'll have to think about that.
Hey, I'd love to. That'd be great. It's I always field questions from people, and people seem to take an interest in it. And I think it's fascinating, and it seems to offer a good career option for many people who may not want to be pilots but still want to be very involved in airline operations and a lot of the similar things, you know, meteorology, aeronautics, and such. So,
very good. Now, you're continuing on with NYCAviation.com, right?
Yes.
That's not
yes,
falling to the wayside.
No, not at all. Very busy with the website as well. Myself and co-owner Matt Molnar, we've been just as busy with that as well. So, yeah, just keeping busy with the site. We're working a lot of stuff behind the scenes, new things coming all the time, and growing and growing, actually. The website gets busier and busier every month.
That's great to hear. All right, good.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah, Rob, what's
up? How come Phil can work for an airline and still do his social media gig, and the kid left because he worked for an airline that wouldn't let him do it? Obviously, they're not the same airline, although we won't mention any names, but I just wondered, Phil, can you get Dan a job where you are so,
so he can come back?
Yeah, I mean, we don't like having you here. It's just, you know.
I wish I could, actually. I think he would enjoy my company. Also keep in mind that's why I have Matt, who, you know, is a co-owner of NYCA now, and whenever something happens pertaining to my own company, I'm completely hands off. You know, I sign a privacy agreement with my airline so that there's even when one would think that there might be any conflict, I'm completely hands off, and nothing, when something pertaining to my airline comes up in the news, I don't exist. So yeah. I completely step away from the NYC Aviation arena. Matt takes full helm, and that's that. So there's really no conflict. You know, NYC Aviation is my baby and has been for 9 years now. But I still have just as much dedication toward my airline as well, and I'm going to respect both companies as I've respected this airline for many years as it's been. You know, it's actually one of my favorite airlines, and I'm pretty lucky to be employed by them. So I value that.
Yeah, good. It sounds like you're handling it in just exactly the right way. So
I hope so. We'll have to ask leadership and see if they're pleased.
All right. Well, we have a guest this episode. Our guest is Ravi.
Wait a minute. You make it sound like we don't normally have one. We have a guest this episode.
We sure do. It's Ravi the Raviator.
Don't you pronounce it Raviator?
Generally, I do. It sort of depends. If you know me, then you call it the Raviator. If you don't, then you call it the Raviator, and people call me Ravi for whatever reason. But the right response is yeah, Ravi the Raviator.
All right. Well, we'll go with that. Ravi the Raviator.
Oh. Wait a minute. It sounds a lot like aviation.
Oh, no. Let's not go there.
Yeah, it's a coincidence, I swear.
Okay. Well, Ravi is a sport pilot. He's also a motivational speaker. And if that's not enough, he's a musician who's played his guitar on Letterman and Leno and some of those kinds of shows. Also at Madison Square Garden and even at the White House. But he gives inspiring presentations on why you need to participate in the magic of flight. So, Ravi, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, and it sounds like it's going to be a fun time with you guys, so I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, it always is. Trust me. Now, you've spoken at AirVenture, Sun and Fun, and at least one AOPA summit, a couple of other places, some colleges, Embry-Riddle, University of North Dakota, and lots of places. So where does this passion for aviation come from?
Well, you know, I think it's something that that I was always interested in as a little kid. I think most little kids are fascinated by the magic of flight and the ability to defy gravity. And but in many cases, we pursue maybe more practical endeavors. And I've decided to pursue another impractical endeavor of music. And, you know, I was really lucky. I've had a great music career and really lived my dreams in that industry, but always had that idea of learning to fly gnawing at me. And so only in 2008 did my wife turn to me and say, you know, you've always wanted to do this, and now you've got some time. Of course, the economy tanked that year, so I wasn't... it was actually because I just wasn't traveling, you know, as much as I'm at that point. I was usually on the road 150 days a year, and that year probably only 75. So, you know, she thought rightly so that it was a great time for me to pursue this other dream that I've always had. And so I went after it, and I just couldn't figure out why people were telling me there was a shrinking pilot population, because I just thought it was absolutely the coolest thing that anybody could do. And that's what sort of got me on my soapbox and trying to figure out why, really, what the industry was doing wrong, because this is naturally, innately, an awesome thing to do. So, and most people want to do it. So what is our industry, or what are the circumstances that exist that are causing people to not do it? And so that's really the approach that I took, and started speaking to the industry on how they can be more effective in terms of recruiting new pilots. And of course, with a pending shrinking pilot population, you know, really there's a good reason for me to be out there doing this.
All right. Sounds terrific. And we're going to listen to some of the music that you've created in a little bit. We're going to talk to you about some of those other aspects of the things that you do with aviation. First, though, we've got a little bit of aviation news from the past week. We'll talk about that. And after that, we'll talk with Ravi some more. That's followed by David's This Week in Aviation History segment. And David, you have an aircraft of the week?
This week, we're going to the South Pacific in World War II and talk about the F-6F Hellcat.
We'll also hear from Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. They'll bring us their Australia desk report. And Peter Johnson, our European contributor, is back with another great Across the Pond segment. And then we'll close out with some listener mail, maybe a couple of Grill the Geeks questions. And that will do it, as they say.
All right. Will that be our exit strategy?
That will be our exit strategy, as we discussed previously. All right. First, though, let's get right into the aviation news. Are you guys all ready?
Ready.
I'm ready.
Our first story is The EU should stand firm on its scheme to limit aviation emissions. Now, this comes from The Guardian. Actually, it comes from The Guardian's environment blog. So, as you might suspect, there's a little bit of an agenda at work here. The subtitle to this is, as long as the coalition of the unwilling tries to stall EU measures, airlines will chase profit regardless of sustainability. Some U.S. senators and about representatives from about 20 countries have met in Washington recently. This is to oppose the European decision to charge airlines for their carbon emissions by including them in this emissions trading scheme, the ETS. And the coalition, according to this article, this post, is unwilling, and they haven't agreed on any kind of a joint declaration, but they quote a U.S. spokesman as saying, the meeting confirmed strong opposition to the ETS, but indicated interest in continuing to work on the suite of activities in the International Civil Aviation Organization to tackle this emissions from aviation. Well, The Guardian says if you listen to this, then you might think that all this just started when really this issue has been before the ICAO for 15 years. And the blog really questions the true commitment of the others involved in this industry. So what do you guys think? We've talked about this a lot. You know, the Europeans are taking a firm stand, they have resisted attempts by others to put this off. The ICAO says that they're going to try to work towards something, but still we don't have anything.
I think the fact that the U.S. government produced a piece of legislation that says that companies, U.S. companies should not be held to this standard, makes it pretty clear the U.S. is not going to go willingly. But, you know, actually having spent a fair amount of time in Europe and having a guy that works for me that lives there, we've had this discussion many, many times. And honestly, I don't think I realized until maybe a year ago just how passionate the people in Europe are, even aviation supporters, about you know, ridding the industry of as much of the carbon emissions as they can. And of course, for years, the industry has always said, well, we don't contribute very much. And the folks in Europe are saying, well, you know what? Let's fix what we do contribute. And America has just not wanted to go down that road at all. They don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah, you know, Robert, Rob, I'll jump in here too, because I live part-time in Europe. And what you say is very true. I mean, there's America's really behind in this conversation, I think. And for a global leader, it bothers me a lot that we're not really more in tune and more proactive, not just in aviation, but across the board in being more green. And you know, it shouldn't be such a political issue. It's just the right thing to do. Here we are as aviators. We have defied gravity, and we've always pushed the envelope in terms of technology and in terms of what we do. Yet when it comes to maybe taking a little bit of responsibility for our carbon footprint, whatever it is, how small or how big it is, we tend to shy away from it. And I think the fact that aviation, America really is the leader of aviation, I think, globally, and the fact that America is behind in this conversation is probably why aviation is behind in this conversation.
Yeah, Ravi, that's an interesting point. You know, I wonder if is our industry, you know, really committed to being greener? I mean, do we believe that fundamentally, yeah, this is an issue that needs to be addressed? We just don't know how to do that? Or do you think that, and the bottom line is we don't really care that much?
Well, you know, I think part of the issue is, you know, our mentality in our industry is we don't really want to be told what to do. We want to do things independently. We want to do it the way that we want and have done it. And we're very individual. And, you know, I think to me, it's very evident that when you go to Oshkosh or when you go to Sun and Fun or any of these big air shows, there is not a single bit of evidence, or at least I'll couch that by saying at least that I could see, of the industry taking an active stance on acknowledging a carbon footprint, whatever it is, and making some level of commitment even if just for appearance's sake, that were interested in doing something about it. And, you know, if it's there at Oshkosh and Son of Fun and places like that, it isn't present enough. Because nobody that I spoke to, and I had this conversation with a number of people at Oshkosh, nobody has seen any evidence of the industry taking a stance on its own responsibility to its carbon footprint.
You know, and that's an interesting word you just used, responsibility, Robbie, because I don't, my own two cents is that I don't believe anybody in our industry in the U.S. believes it is their responsibility. It's not mine, it's yours. And of course, I mean, and even people I know at many of the major aircraft manufacturers will tell you that, hey, you know what? I mean, what can we do? I mean, we do the best we can to design aircraft that are as aerodynamic and efficient as possible. We don't build the motors, so we don't really have a role in that. And what else can we do? I mean, there's not much else to do. But of course, we don't have any kind of a national conversation about the environment really at the Washington level. But also, I do think what you said before about us being a leader, you know, I hate to sound like such a naysayer, but I wonder if that's really not starting to change. And I don't mean simply because of the incredible amounts of our industry that have been going to Asia. But simply in the fact that I think other countries realize how difficult it seems to have become for us to negotiate anything. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a middle ground on much of anything, not just in our industry, but in a lot of things. And while we try to keep politics out of the show, I mean, I just don't think that the Republicans or the Democrats or the Independents have anything to look at to say, well, yeah, we're right and they're not. I mean, yeah. Nobody wants to give.
Well, it's a sticky issue, especially in an election season. But, you know, I think you're right. America is losing its ground in that regard. But aviation, I believe, don't quote me on it, but I believe aviation is pretty much still America's number one export or its only yes. remaining export. And we produce a lot of pilots here, even if they're contract pilots from China or India that are coming here to study. So, you know, it is a significant contribution that America gives to the world is through aviation. And so all the more reason why it's important that we take a forward, proactive, future-looking approach to this issue. And there are, you know, certainly in the ultralight world, I mean, it should be acknowledged there are people there at that level that are very focused on this. And, you know, the president of Flight Design is a good example. You know, he's very focused and proactive, and this is one of his major initiatives.
I think that Boeing takes actually many strides to improve the environment. I mean, first of all, the environment, it's so important. I mean, we said the word responsibility, and it's the same way I clean my house is the same way I have a responsibility toward the earth. I mean, it's where we live, just on a larger scale. I mean, that's just a basic human decency. And I think Boeing has been pretty active. I see that they market that a lot. You know, GE also, especially with their engines, they talk about that. And because they're trying to sell their product all around the world to places where it is more important to them. I think the big problem comes down to the airlines. You know, we're using the word industry. The airline industry is not in the business of being environmental. They're in the business of making money, which is just the truth, you know, which sounds evil and everything like that. But
that's the way it is.
And it is, you know, and the word sustainability has been redefined over the past decade to almost only pertain to the environment, but it needs to be truly economically sustainable as well. And there have not been many options. And it comes down to innovation and everything with that. And the American airline industry has had a very difficult decade. Airlines are only now kind of readapting to, you know, being healthy. You know, airlines that have only in the past couple of years come out of bankruptcy and adapting to mergers and everything like that. Only now can they even start to consider, hey, what's our next step? Can we start doing this? And some of what I'm seeing with the emissions trading scheme, it seems as though it's like, hey, these are our standards. If you don't meet them, we're going to punish you. We're going to tax you. the airline industry is already overly taxed. It needs to be the opposite. It needs to be a reward and benefit. Hey, if you meet these standards, you'll be taxed less. Airlines will step up if it means saving money. Everyone's going to cry out.
You think
they
will? I wish I could. I don't know. Maybe I'm not as faithful to our American airlines here. I mean, look at you mentioned Europe. I mean, Air France is in terrible shape financially, and yet they are a part of this whole trading scheme. And I think this has become such a political hot potato because of something we talked about earlier. That in the old days, America always led the way. America said, "We're going to do this. We're going to do that." And here's and people went, wow, that's really impressive. And now we're getting pushed from folks in Europe that say, you know what? You guys are dragging your feet. If you don't want to come up with something, here's our plan. And of course, nobody in America likes that. But I don't. And while I'm not disagreeing that maybe they have, overstepped somewhat in the way that it's come across, I guess if I felt like I heard people in D.C. doing more than just saying, well, we're not putting up with that. And again, let's go back to that piece of legislation that said that the U.S. government didn't believe American airline, and I don't mean American the airline, but I'm saying U.S. airlines could be held accountable for any of this stuff going on in Europe. I mean, I'm not saying, we're right and they're wrong. I'm just saying that I don't see any middle ground coming there anywhere.
Well, okay, my time to chime in.
Go ahead, David.
I refuse to pay additional higher airfares.
Yeah, there you
go. Because the EU has said that, it doesn't matter what the airlines do, because if the EU taxes the airlines, guess who's going to pay it? Not the airlines. I mean, it was close to $1,000 to fly me for 3 days to Oshkosh. So why should I pay for carbon taxes in Europe? Because United, if they have to pay it, they're not going to pay it all, just force it on the international customers. They're going to force it on the whole airline. Maybe it's me being cynical, but I don't give a damn. I want to be able to fly where I want to fly, and I want to be able to fly reasonably. So if the EU starts putting this tax on my airfares, that's not my problem. If that's their decision, not my problem.
Well, I think David's point is a good one, actually, because what Phil was saying is totally right. It's a dollar and cents issue, and the airlines are taxed heavily. It's also a very subsidized industry, especially on the regional level, which I think allows the government, if it's going to step up, to say, hey, we subsidize a lot of this, and so the industry has to take a proactive stance on it. But ultimately, what David is saying is right. It's going to come down to the cost of our tickets. And so the American people and the American public and forget about America, and let's talk about this as a world. The global public has to step up and say we're willing to pay more in order to be more responsible, because in the end, in the long term, for our children, for our grandchildren, this is going to save resources. This is of value. And but of course, when our airlines and so many of our companies are publicly traded, nobody's looking more than 3 months ahead.
I can't lie. Also, first, I mean, it's only a political issue because no politician on either side is doing anything about it. It wouldn't be a political issue otherwise if more politicians, to me, were just taking some sort of initiative. And honestly, a lot of it is going to come down to, I think, innovation. Let's see some more inventions. I've been hearing talk about the future for 15 years, and when is the future going to be now? And I just haven't seen anything. And this is when, honestly, personally, another aspect of aviation, I'm always going to go back to the space program. We're going to start seeing advancements in technologies when we start pushing the limits and when we need to go to Mars. We just landed on Mars, and all we're going to learn so much. New technologies are going to force us to come up with other technologies and other innovations and new energy, and hopefully, it all trickles back down to the rest of the world, hopefully including the airline industry. And that's we need more ideas, and the airlines need more options other than well, I can buy a cleaner engine. It can't be just that. And it can't be a punishment structure either. There needs to be benefit. It can't be this negative reinforcement. You know, but the EU is legitimate in saying, hey, US, it's time to pick it up. But we just need to pick
it up. Why? If you look at the carbon emissions in the world, where do we rank? Because we fly more, we're penalized more. I mean, that's the bottom line.
I don't think we're penalized. I just think we need to be clean, whether you're complaining or not.
Well, according to the EU, we need to be penalized because we fly more.
I don't know if I necessarily agree that it's a penalty. I don't know. I know we need to move on, but I, just one thought I guess I had when this whole EU thing started a couple of years ago with the, you know, everybody's going to pay our tax. I wondered if it wasn't a negotiating tactic. You know, I'm going to be really, really tough on David when I negotiate his airfare to Oshkosh next year, because I know that eventually we're going to settle for something that we both can agree on, but at least gives us the opportunity to say we led the way. And I wonder if that's not where we're headed, except that it seems to have been stuck now for a couple of years in the same spot.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. Anyway. I don't think this issue is going to go away for sure.
I'm just kidding, David. You can still come to Oshkosh next year.
No, I agree with you though. It's a penalty. I mean, if your logic was it was going to be a negotiating tactic, where the hell's the negotiation?
Well, that's, thank you. I'm right there with you. That's the part I don't get.
The EU is drawing a line in the sand, and their comment is because the United States and other nations like China, other countries that do more flying than they do, it's in their opinion that we need to be paying more because we're, quote, polluting their air. Not polluting the globe, but polluting European air. So, I mean, it's not a UN dictate coming out saying that everybody has to pay it. It's just if you fly to the EU, you have to pay that tax.
Ooh, I smell a whole show coming up here, man.
I know.
Yeah, but I think that's, you know, that's probably the way it's going to go, and it makes sense. I mean, there are a lot of taxes you pay in various countries when arriving or departing from European country that you don't pay domestically. And I think that competition here, and along with deregulation, is going to consistently keep the airfare war low enough where such taxes will probably only be imposed on the premium, if you will, premium passenger who isn't going to balk at it, or at least the international traveler.
Mm. All right. Well, we do need to move on. I think this is, like I say, an issue that's definitely not going away. And personally, while I'm not a real big fan of the ETS as a method to accomplish this, I do give the Europeans some credit for putting a stake in the ground. It's just sort of unfortunate that the rest of the world hasn't stepped up to that and either, you know, work with them or offer an alternative. That's, you know, it'd be nice if we moved this issue forward instead of keeping it stalled the way it seems to be. So, okay, let's move on. We have time for just a little bit more news. Just real quick, we had some near collisions, I guess, or some close encounters. We have an item from the LA Times titled, U.S. Airways Planes Were Not on a Collision Course, FAA Chief Says. And Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood and the FAA Administrator Michael Herta say, quote, there was loss of separation, unquote, when three aircraft around Ronald Reagan National Airport got a little close. Rob, it's been kind of interesting looking in the press. I mean, some of them made it sound like, you know, a collision was just narrowly averted. Is that really what happened?
Well, I think we need to be very succinct with the words here. And I believe it said that they were not in danger of colliding, although they were on a collision course. For people that don't know the runway layout at Reagan, there's a major north-south runway and a shorter northwest-southeast. But these are all pretty much aircraft departing runway 1, which kind of heads you at the Washington Monument, and you have to make that quick turn to not. I don't think Well, Washington's not really buried there, is he? That's just a monument to him. Well, anyway.
Yeah, right. Well.
So no, I just wondered. I just wondered if it was going
to Rob, he's buried south of the airport at Mount Vernon.
Right. I knew that. Okay. All right. So I'm a little history.
Oh, and by the way, Martha's buried there too.
Well, it was his girlfriend. But the point was, they were in the middle of a runway change, and they were changing from departing to the north to arriving from the south. Departing to the north to arriving from the north. And when they arrive from the north, they come down that river visual, which brings them down the Potomac. And if you haven't flown into Reagan on that approach, it's pretty cool because you basically get aimed at the Washington Monument, and then you make this hard right turn just at a bend in the river, and you land on runway 19 at Reagan, and it's pretty cool. But somehow there was not enough coordination, and they launched a couple of departures on a northbound heading after approach control had already cleared somebody inbound on the river visual headed the other way. And if you listen to the tape on Live ATC, you can hear their voices change. I don't know whether the person that was working the tower at Reagan was training or whatever, but you hear someone that sounded a little more dramatic get in there, and certainly they just turned the first aircraft, the inbound, away from the departures. And once that happened, the crisis was somewhat averted, although the airplane that was inbound was a little short on fuel. But it's a problem, but I don't believe it was near the crisis that they made it out to be in the press.
And I think they said this was some kind of a communications problem.
Yeah, and again, when you know, because the tower is at Reagan, but Potomac Tracon is located somewhere else. Phil, do you know where it's physically located? I can't remember. I know it's physically, not on the airport.
Leesburg.
Oh, that's right, Leesburg. Okay. And so, I mean, the people are completely removed. They're coordinating on the phone. And when you switch runway configurations, you've got to make sure the tower says, okay, we're cleared to go the other way. And somehow that coordination fell through the cracks. And the approach controller thought they were cleared to bring them inbound from the north, and they weren't. And so, but again, the person working the tower at Reagan managed to say, hey, turn 30 degrees this way and get out of the way of the two departures, and that's how they solved the problem.
One of the multiple layers of safety took care of the one mistake, you know, and
yeah.
That's kind of how I see it, you know. It's a mistake that happens, you know, and all of this came into light only because they busted the airspace limitation of distance. And once that happens, paperwork needs to be filed and people do their reports and all this stuff. And it gets looked at or investigated, you know, however, whatever the level of severity or buzzword you want to use, whatever sounds, you know, scarier in the media. And, you know, I don't think is it important? Yeah. Should it be taken seriously? Of course. But I just think, you know, it happened and it's not incredibly severe. But then I guess that's what the media does, you know.
Well, however, and as we're talking today, we're it's a Monday as we're recording this, and today, and we were talking before we started that in the Wall Street Journal there was a headline story about an American Airlines 777 and a flight of Air Force C-17s that went nose to nose, same altitude. And David, how far away did you say they were laterally when they passed?
2,000 feet.
2,000 feet. So figure each of them's probably doing 450 knots. The closure rate didn't give anybody much time. If the TCAS hadn't gone off, they would have run together. And that was a big deal.
And that was at 22,000 feet. I read.
Yes,
that wasn't
correct.
Close to. That wasn't at some low. We're all, you know, all converging on approach to this runway or this arrival path. That was at a higher altitude. You know, you think a little bit more open air.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, let's push on. The New York Times has an interesting piece about a woman named Susie Pugliastusti, or something close to that, who founded a charter airline in Indonesia. She's got 45 airplanes. They run about 200 flights a day. They have about 200 destinations, and they provide a lot of good service to that area. They carry produce and mining and palm oil executives. They carry commuters, even things like rice and cement and fuel. But Susie Air has a problem, and that is finding enough pilots. we've talked about that in the past, and we've, I think a week or two ago, we talked about, or we mentioned Boeing's forecast for the number of pilots that are going to be required over the next 20 years or so worldwide. And, you know, this is sort of a real world example happening today. Here's a successful business. They want to expand, but they can't find pilots.
Well, I threw that one in only because of exactly what you just said, that we've been talking about the need for pilots, and it's not just in the U.S. I mean, 20 years ago, when I flew charter and things like that, one of my best buddies was a Swedish citizen. And since I'm of Swedish descent, you know, we got to be good friends. But I mean, he came to the United States to get his licenses, and he knew this was the place where all the jobs were, and he got a lot of experience. And so now it's kind of changing, though, because jobs are in other places. And I don't mean that people are necessarily going to go to Indonesia and make a career out of flying Suzy Air's airplanes. Those are 15-17 seat Cessna Caravans, the single engine turboprop. But imagine if you had picked up your certificates here in the States and you said, how in the world am I ever going to get to be an airline pilot? Because I only have 450 hours in my logbook and I need 1,500 before they'll ever hire me on. Oh my, what will I do? Well, do the same thing a lot of those people that came to the United States 20 years ago did. Go somewhere else and get a couple of years of experience under your belt doing something and come back. And then, you know, you might be qualified for the job. And that was really why I threw that in there, because I just thought it just seemed to dramatize, the place for U.S. pilots to go when they say we have no place to go to get any experience. Well, they do. They just may not want to go.
Well, exactly.
Ravi, Ravi.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is one of the things I talk about in my presentation is that to me, this is a huge incentive to become a pilot, because you have the opportunity to use your skills for not only, a growing economy in India or China or, Indonesia, but for the humanitarian ability too, and the opportunity to do something humanitarian while gaining the hours that you need, especially if these pilots come back and are going to require an ATP in order to get in the right seat of a regional. I think that's a carrot to grow the pilot population. What's interesting, you know, is that there are just fewer and fewer people enrolling in and completing their certificates in flight schools in America. So exporting our pilots, you know, may or may not be a reality, because we may not have enough, you know, and I don't think we will have enough to fulfill our own needs here. What's interesting, though, too, is that I could name a handful of pilots who are over the age of 60 who are flying either internationally for an international carrier now, because they were laid off from Delta and don't have their pensions, so they had to go get another job for an airline that would hire within their age bracket. But I also, not so long ago, was on a flight from Bombay to Bangalore and sitting in a spice jet 737 listening to a pilot with a very strong Floridian accent, and after the flight, I went into the cockpit to see who it was, and sure enough, he's a retired American pilot, been with American for 30 years, and decided he wanted to go somewhere that was going to pay him better and treat him with more respect, and he wound up flying for SpiceJet in India on a 1-year contract, and he's still there now, total 3 years, I believe, and I don't think he has any intention of coming home.
Mm-hmm. One thing I think that's worth also mentioning is the aviation industry changes country to country, and the standards are different. And there's a reason that the odds of dying in a plane crash in the U.S. are the same as being struck by lightning 7 times, because we've had enough crashes to where we've had to learn enough horrible lessons to make it safer eventually. Suzy Air doesn't have an amazing safety record either. And you go to certain parts of the world and you fly and it's great and it's awesome. I know people that they've passed on airline jobs to go fly DC-3s up in Alaska and do the whole, you know, that whole thing, and all, you know, and it's great. And I've gotten to travel the world and go to places with my former airline, and I was walking through the streets of these cities. It's different, and it's maybe not as safe, you know, like I would always second guess the, maintenance of the planes. Parts are not as easily available. I'm literally looking, reading right now, like, it's just Wikipedia, so you take it with a grain of salt, but fuel pump failure caused an accident and all these things which are mechanical issues because they don't have various resources. It's a very different world, and it's not always as safe and glamorous and awesome, you know, but a wonderful experience, you know, if you happen to come back home with all these hours. Yeah, definitely. But it does come at a price, and people need to be aware before they blindly go off to take some airline gig on the other side of the globe. Mm.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
All right. Just quickly, I see that Obama signed the Pilots Bill of Rights, putting that into effect. And I think that's a good thing, right? That's protection for pilots. Primarily when there's accidents, things like that. Isn't that what that's mostly about?
Yeah. I think it's smart. I was reading it, and I tried to do a little searching about it, and I was amazed. It's like, okay, so pilots that are being investigated now have access to all the evidence against them. Why did this law need to be created now? I don't understand. I'm trying to find opposition to this, or what the other side was, or what I couldn't even find a problem that caused this, because it seems so, you know, most airlines or pilots are unionized, and I can't imagine a union that would tolerate not having access to investigative documents.
I can tell you a little bit about where this particular Bill of Rights started, and I believe if you look, one of the sponsors was Senator is it Inhofe? I can never pronounce his name.
I think so.
Inhofe. And one of the reasons that this whole thing came to be is that he's a pilot. And it's not just that he has sympathy for this whole issue, because Phil, what you said is absolutely true. I have no idea how this could have been on the books as long as it is. But the point is that Senator Inhofe was on a flight in his, I believe he has a Cessna 340. It's an older twin engine piston airplane. And he landed at an airport when the runway was closed. He landed over the top of a bunch of construction workers on an airport that had a big X on the end of the runway. And for people that may not be pilots, the X on the runway is the, hey, hello, the runway is closed. And he landed anyway. And you know, the ins and outs of why he did or he didn't notice it or hadn't seen the NOTAMs or whatever, I can't speak to that specifically. My guess is that that's how he found out that a citizen pilot, as opposed to perhaps an airline pilot, does not have as much access to all the information as they should. And so once he realized how difficult it was, not to mention the fact that he did kind of land on a closed runway. He said, we got to fix this. So in a kind of an awkward way, he learned the hard way that this problem existed. And again, Phil, as you said, I don't even know how this lasted as long as it did without this kind of legislation.
I mean, I'm guessing that the pilot always had the right to the information, but it may just not have been accessible or too bureaucratic or something. And this least gives the pilot the legal right to say that it's a priority to get this information. I'm not sure, but that's how I interpret it.
Well, I think more rights for pilots are a good thing.
Can't argue with that. Coming right up is our conversation with Robbie, but first, this message.
This is Rob Mark, and we are at one of the best places in the world to talk with our friends from AOPA, an air show. In fact, one of the best air shows in the entire world.
That would be the best air show in the entire world.
Let me rephrase that. At the best air show in the entire world, and that voice you may have heard in the background was my friend Binay Wilson. And Binay, we're standing under a Husky, I believe, here at the AOPA booth at Air Venture. And you have a new program that you wanted to tell people about. I think it's called the Aviator.
We are going to start offering a free membership to youth aged 13 to 18, and we're very excited about it. We want to get young kids excited about aviation early on. It becomes a lifetime hobby. We just ask that you go over to the AOPA website, the member section. We actually are going to have a special link on the website. We'd love to have as many people sign up as possible. And on the other side of that, we're also asking people to donate so that we can help pay for these memberships, because they're free for for the kids. We're trying to get our members to volunteer, buy memberships, and sponsor some of these kids. But the kids will get the memberships no matter what. We're all after the same goal, more people flying and enjoying the benefits of aviation.
They don't have to be pilots, do they? They just have to be airplane enthusiasts.
Yes, they do. I think once they get this membership and they see all the benefits and they start getting our magazines and just see the joy of flying, it's going to make them want to learn how to fly.
Cool. Certainly, we are so happy to have AOPA as a sponsor of the Airplane Geeks and, of course, Jetwine.com. Benay Wilson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Mark.
Again, our guest this episode is Ravi, a pilot and an aviation industry advocate. I guess that's one way to describe you, Ravi. Is that how do you introduce yourself to – how do you explain to your mother what you do for a living?
I try not to. When I, as soon as I say I'm a musician and a pilot, she hangs up on me.
That's about it. Speaking of music, you've been blending those two lately, or maybe you have for a while. I don't know. But recently at Oshkosh, you produced something very interesting.
Well, you know, the music influence in what I speak about in the aviation industry has gone on since the beginning of my speaking career, which was in 2008. I started training in March of 2008. I gave my first lecture in April of 2008, and I got my license in September of 2008. And really what it was from the student perspective. I mean, how does someone who, you know, who has maybe lived their dream in another field become attracted to aviation? And so the conversation of music, because it's my background, was always a big part of what I talk about. What struck me as a big surprise is that 50%, 49.7% of pilots play a musical instrument. I really thought I was the only one when I first started doing this. But I'd go from airport to airport, and of course, I'd meet plenty of pilots, but I was meeting musician after musician as well. And so, you know, I started looking into that and realized that just about half of all pilots play a musical instrument. So it's become an asset for me because it allows me to communicate with the aviation industry's target audience on a level that isn't about aviation.
But the difference is that there may be pilots that play instruments, but you actually play them well. See, there are many pilots out there and not so good.
It's always funny when I ask my audiences, you know, how many people play a musical instrument. And, you know, you get a few hands up and then a few more come up. But, you know, those last 10 hands or so that come up, I really don't want to hear those guys play. It took them that long to figure out if they play a musical instrument.
Yeah. Well, the piece that Rob turned us on to is called
Air Venturous.
Air Venturous.
Right. It's sort of in homage to really what is the greatest air show in the world, Air Venture.
Well, why don't we listen to just a little bit of that?
Young kid sitting all alone, texting someone on the telephone. There's a world around he can't see. Lost in virtual reality. Just open your eyes and you see there's greatness in humanity. I know a place to rock your world. Come on, come on, let's go. Here on the ground, just look around, surrounded by a field of everything you want it to be, gonna blow your mind. That's what it means to be adventurous.
So, Ravi, what motivated you to write that? I mean, how did that come together?
Well, I mean, you know, it was a conversation I had with Robert that made me think that this would be a good idea. You know, he thought that here we have this great air show and maybe could use a theme song. And
our Rob?
Your Rob, yeah.
You're kidding.
I didn't disagree. Yeah.
I told you I just don't play musical instruments very well. It doesn't mean I'm a complete buffoon.
Well, I didn't know that you were such the inspiration. I'm impressed,
Rob.
I
don't know. You know, it's a crazy thing because I was watching, I don't know what I was watching, some other event tied to some completely different industry, and they had somebody playing, and I said, you know, that's what we need. We need a good, lively tune that people think about when they're at AirVenture. Everybody says it's the greatest air show in the whole world, and just seemed like it needed music.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know. I called Ravi up one day and I said, hey, you ever thought about writing a tune like that? I said, I don't know what it takes to do that. I have no clue, but it just seemed like a good idea, but I can't help you at all. And then I hung up on him. And then he went to work.
just like my mother. You hung up on him.
Yeah, right.
Now, is that you singing as well as playing, Ravi?
I did all the vocals and played all the instruments on that track. And it was, music is a great way to communicate in general, but because of that statistic that I mentioned, it's a great way to communicate with pilots and with people that are interested in becoming pilots. So the opportunity to create a song that celebrates the air show, which is really what the chorus is all about, describing what a great thing AirVenture is. The verses are really targeting are the people that we want to become pilot. You know, the kid who's sitting there texting on his phone and doesn't realize, you know, hey, here's an opportunity to participate in one of humanity's greatest achievements, aviation. And so the song is, in a sense, our industry not only celebrating itself, but also reaching out to the general population and saying, come join us, because this is truly an amazing, exceptional, unparalleled opportunity and experience.
Ravi, I spend a lot of time also trying to, you know, promote aviation with the same thing, and I always use the same reference as I've seen you mention in some of your videos and writing about defying gravity. You know, how amazing that is, and it's not normal. Can you tell us a little bit about your take on that? I thought that was great.
Sure. I mean, one of the things I feel like, you know, you can push me off of a boat and I'm going to float in the water. It's natural. Or you can shove me out the door and I'm going to be able to walk on land because it's natural. But there's just absolutely nothing natural about flying. It's the one thing where we've defeated Mother Nature. We defy gravity. We do that often without even respecting it or thinking about it anymore. We take it for granted that we actually do that. But I know of nothing else really other than flight where that is so obvious of how humanity has excelled and really achieved something that, you know, perhaps is one of our oldest dreams, is to fly like a bird.
Now, Ravi, is that kind of the theme for most of your speaking engagements?
The theme is really it's about growing the pilot population through inspiration, and in my opinion, that concept is one of the most inspiring ways to communicate with the target audience is to relish our accomplishment. And I'm a fan of saying that we're elite, and the word elite is not politically correct, but I think we shouldn't shy away from it because it's an incredible accomplishment. And we're not saying we're better than you. We're saying we're pretty special, and we want you to be part of that. We want to bring more of you into this. And that's the reason why we're special, because we have defeated Mother Nature in that way. And we make an incredible commitment. I mean, not just to learn to fly, but an incredible commitment to maintain our status as pilots, whether it's, through the hoops that we have to jump through to stay current and stay safe and to enjoy this amazing opportunity of flight.
You told me that once you learned to fly, it somehow changed the way you seem to view the rest of the world. Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit? I don't know if I said it quite right, but
no, I mean that's actually a line in the song as well. About the character, about how now that he flies, he sees the world in a different way, and it's completely changed what he does and how he thinks. And that's me in a nutshell, in a sense. I don't know. You think about it. I've really been so lucky in my music career and played all those great shows and some great stages. Yet somehow getting in a single engine plane by myself and flying over the Blue Ridge Mountains is a phenomenal, life changing experience that tests everything that I know and everything that I don't know about myself. And that changes one's perception on life. And then there are more tangible things too. Like, for example, I don't, I was one of those guys that left my house 3 or 4 times making sure the coffee pot was off, but now I have a flow. I have a 90-second flow through my entire house, and I leave the house once. So I become, and that's something I learned in the cockpit. So I become a much more efficient human being, and, you know, I don't do a full walk around of my car every time, but I take that I take that general look as I walk up to it, and I spot things and I see things, and I'm more. The word is aware. That's what aviation teaches you, to be aware. And I find in society more and more people are less aware, which is why I wrote in Flight Training Magazine a couple of years ago that I believe that if every kid had to learn to fly an airplane in order to graduate high school, America wouldn't be falling behind on the world's education stage.
Mm, it's true.
Yeah.
And life becomes checklist driven.
Yeah, or flow driven. And
but you can certainly do math in your head.
Well, you know, hey, I must have spent at least a year in a trigonometry course and I didn't learn anything, but put me in a cockpit for a couple of months, all of a sudden I understand it.
Ravi, one thing also, you know, I've also seen, I know some of your views on what keeps people away from flying and such, the challenges, whether it's, you know, the cost, and some people, you know, always give that excuse also, oh, life is too busy when things settle. You know, I think that flying also isn't just, you know, you don't have to just be a pilot to defy gravity. You can be a passenger, a crew member, like a flight attendant or anything. There's so many ways to get up in the air, and I think it's great, and I think all facets should be promoted. What is it that you think really keeps people away from aviation in general? You know, that there seems to be this negative mantra behind it, and you seem to, you know, I know that you battle that so much in what you do. What is it that keeps people away or makes them nervous or scared or just not willing to take that last step?
Well, I mean, I think it can be either a lack of trust in themselves or perhaps a lack of trust in the equipment. People are concerned, you know, that the equipment is not going to be safe enough. But really what I think in the larger issue is, when I started speaking on aviation, I would just go up to people in the grocery store or wherever, and I'd say, so what do you think of flying? And the response was almost always the same. Oh, it's such a hassle. You know, I hate dealing with the airport and the lines and the cramped conditions. But my question wasn't, what do you think of airports and airlines? My question was, what do you think of flying? So there's an immediate association that the general public makes with aviation, which is the hassle of commercial transportation through an airline. So I think, you know, educating people that actually general aviation exists. Many people don't know what general aviation is. They couldn't define it, and they aren't aware of the fact that there's an airport within 5 miles of them because it doesn't have an airline going to it. So awareness, again, is a key issue. And yeah, people in general, especially, you know, in terms of specifically the pilots or potential pilots, you know, costs, people think it's more expensive than it is, but I don't believe that people are cost sensitive. I think people are value sensitive. And so if you get into our flight training industry and you observe that, you know, one of our biggest problems is that 8 out of every 10 student pilots drop out before achieving their certificate, then you realize that we're doing something wrong in our training. I mean, certainly we don't want to have 100% success rate because not everybody should be a pilot. There are certain people that just, you know, their strengths are elsewhere. But we need to have a higher than 20% success rate. And, you know, a lot of that, I think, is providing a better experience and, you know, to have better CFIs who are not just hour builders, who are really focused on helping people live their dream. And that can be as simple as reminding CFIs themselves about their own flight training experience. I often tell flight school managers, you know, put it in your schedule to have a conversation once a month with every one of your CFIs, just a quick one, about where do they go on their first cross-country solo or whatever it is to reorient them with their own student experience. And then they'll be better teachers, and teachers will give better experiences to their students and will improve student retention.
Are there many, and honestly, I'm not familiar too much, and my girlfriend is actually a private pilot herself and everything, and I should ask her. But, I mean, are there other payment programs or, like what can people do to, you know, take care, because the costs are do become astronomical, even beyond just your private pilot's license. What do you do when, you know, like, are schools offering, hey, you know, pay it off like a student loan over a length of time, and how far can you go? Like how can it become, at least cost wise, more accessible to people? Well, you know, inner city kids and such like that. It is looked at by many as being, you know, oh, the privileged get to fly, you know.
Well, yeah, and you know, I mean, I think that, you know, that's a tough question to answer in terms of the privileged get to fly, because the bottom line is, compared to many activities, flight training is expensive. However, compared to many activities that the privileged do, it's you know, not necessarily that expensive. So, you know, one of the things that that I talk to flight schools about is forming a payment program, just like you mentioned. And I sort of came up with this idea because when I'm a sport pilot, so right then already I'm flying for less money than a private pilot learning to fly. But if I add up everything that I spent to get my pilot's license and I amortize it over 12 months, I realized I spent $500 a month. And I said that in my very first lecture at Sun and Fun in 2008, and somebody popped up in the audience and said, you know, I pay more than that for my car. So it occurred to me that, you know, people can budget for a car payment. Why can't they budget for their flight training if it's presented properly? And then they don't really think about the cost factor so much, because it's sort of a set amount every time. And you know, 12 months is not that unreasonable. I think the average length of time the average person takes to get their pilot certificate is well over 12 months.
But I do think that Phil has a good point about, and Phil, correct me if I'm wrong, I guess I was hearing that you were also thinking about how people that want some of those advanced ratings that might want a career as a pilot, you know, can make the money come together in the right place at the right time. Or I don't know, is that where you were going?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I mean, you know, if money were not an issue, who would want to stop at their private pilot's license? You know, let's keep going. Let's start, you know, people want to stay involved. People who get to that point want to learn more, and they want to do more. And people who do want to become career pilots. That's why, you know, so many pilots, airline pilots, they're so upset because they enter this industry after having, you know, they start with a regional airline making horrible, I mean, honestly, starting out making horrible money. They already went through all the hassle of paying for flight training and everything for so long that to me, they already put in their time. And then they have to, again, put in their time, you know, in order to climb and increase their pay grades with the airlines. Yeah. It's a challenge, and it's you know.
Well, sure it does, but you know what? It's going to go right back to what David said earlier in the conversation about EU taxation on emissions. I mean, ultimately, the consumer is going to have to pay that price. And, you know, air tickets are cheap, and cheaper probably than they should be. And that's why airlines do lose money, and why they need subsidies in order to operate. Because, you know, we are all flying. The flying public is flying at a price that doesn't stabilize the industry. It makes it, you know, impossible for the industry to be self-sustaining. So, you know, the fact that the guy you're talking about, the student, you know, graduates with $160,000 worth of debt and then gets a $20,000 job in the right seat of a regional, has gotten so bad to the point where banks don't even, you know, give loans anymore to aeronautical students. It's just not viable. You know, it is. It's a huge problem. But you know, the thing is that the cost isn't really going to change that much. I mean, the cost is what it is to learn to fly. I mean, and people, if they're having a good experience, people find the money. They just do. I mean, not everybody's going to be a pilot. Bottom line is, not everybody's going to be a pilot. But those who really want it, and those who are given a good experience, like anything, will find the money to do it.
And if I can just add something into that discussion, because I did, you know, go the professional route and spent a lot of my time and money. And see, it's funny, Phil, when you said, you know, people have put in all their time and they end up at a regional airline and they're making lousy wages. And it was the same thing 30 years ago. I mean, that philosophy has not changed, right, wrong, or otherwise. I don't think I liked it then, and I doubt any of the people that are in that situation like it now. But the point is that you do have to pay your dues somehow to gather that experience. And the new law that's going in for Part 121 carriers is going to make that even more difficult. It doesn't mean that it's – I'm not saying I agree with it or not. I'm just saying it's another piece of the dues. And you know, I guess people that want to be doctors go through an awful lot of grief as well. I mean, with medical school, you know, pre-med, medical school, residencies, you know, if they're lucky enough to get fellowships. However, the one thing that I think that's really important here is that if you do look in some other countries, and we can look into the Middle East or in parts of Asia, Singapore and Emirates are two airlines that come to mind that have said, you know what, we're going to have a pilot problem. However, we also believe that if we want to get people, if we want to get good people to come and work for us, we're going to have to help them because these kids don't have the finances to be able to do this on our own. So what if we help them get their ratings, but you know, said, look, if we help you, you got to come work for us for 8 or 9 years after we help you. And they turn people away for these cadet programs at these two carriers. And now, of course, here in the United States, you know, that has not happened because most airlines here in the States do not believe that's their responsibility or something they want to become involved in. But there are other countries that are at least trying to take that first step to address that issue that you mentioned. And unfortunately, it's not happening here. And I don't think it's really happening in Europe either, although I believe Lufthansa used to do it a long time ago, but I think they stopped.
Well, can I say that my former airline, North American Airlines, gave me my dispatch certificate by scholarship with a 2-year contract.
Get out. I didn't. That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's nice.
And it was great. It was literally
a great story. I didn't know that.
It was an essay contest put out to employees, and they sent a group of people that won. I think there were 4 people that they sent. We went to school and we came out with our dispatch certificates, and some of us went on to become actual dispatchers. It became a path to toward management for one guy and everything, and that was great. And that was honestly life-changing for me. I mean, would I have had the opportunity? Would I have gone to spend the $5,000 for that course if I didn't get that, or at least at that time in my life, to do that? So I got a scholarship, and I went through it, and you know, this is where I am now, and it's thanks to that, you know.
That's a good point. And there are a lot of scholarships out there too. You know, I was just talking to one of the recruiters for Western Michigan University last week, and he was saying, you know, a lot of these students are very lazy, and they don't realize that that there are all these scholarships out there, and they may not be much in many cases. They're $1,000 or $1,500, but you know, you can go get 10 or 20 of them if you qualify. And you know, I'm involved in one of these small scholarship programs as well. Sennheiser Aviation Headsets is the title sponsor of a scholarship program called Live Your Dream, of which I'm an ambassador. And Live Your Dream is, you know, basically giving away one each month of a $1,500 scholarship, and it's an essay contest, and you know, they're giving away one each month, and that will help somebody, you know, start their flight training and see if it's for them, and hopefully get hooked and then find the money for the rest of it. So, you know, there are resources out there for students and for people who are interested in learning to fly, but you got to work a little bit for it.
And Ravi, even if those scholarships are a small dollar amount, you know, any young kid that sits there and says, hey, you know what, there was an essay contest or something and someone believed in me, that's going to motivate them to do more and to be a more active participant. You know, that dollar value, it goes so much more beyond that.
I agree. I tell it to people all the time. Just the process of writing that essay and putting your reasons of why you want to learn to fly down on paper, you know, is a step is it some form of a commitment or step or affirmation of your interest that I think does carry you a long way. And then the validation of even winning that goes even further. Yeah.
A lot of my original question not pertained, and I wasn't saying, you know, what one side is right or wrong with the rookie airline pilots and such, but a lot of it did pertain to the accessibility for the less fortunate. You know, the kids that, like LaGuardia Airport has a Kids Day event every September with Kiwanis Club, and I see these kids who have never even seen a plane up close, much less flew on one as a passenger, and I'm like, wow, they've never flown on a plane. Like, I look at them and they're so excited. They want to fly them someday, and it's so sad to think, you know, these young kids are developing this passion for aviation and they don't have an outlet, no way to get up in the air. So I just try to think, you know, the scholarship. I mean, Ravi, you say you're involved with promoting some of those scholarships. I think that's great, and as someone in aviation who wants to promote that, thank you. I think that's great, and I would love to help promote that. I want to hear more about that sometime.
Tell us how we can find that, Ravi. I know you mentioned the one from Sennheiser. Is that just up on their website somewhere?
Yes, go to Sennheiser-LiveYourDream.
You mean live our dream or live your dream?
Live your dream.
Oh, not yours, Ravi. You meant in general. Okay, I was just wondering.
Sennheiser-LiveYourDream, and that's where all the information and the application forms, and you can do a video entry, and you know, you don't even have to write it all down. You know, that's where you can make your case and hopefully win a scholarship.
And we'll put that link in the show notes.
I was going to say another good resource that people should know about for anybody interested in flying. Obviously, you have to get your private to begin with. But Women in Aviation, the Women in Aviation group gives away just tens and tens of thousands of dollars worth of scholarships each and every year. And I think being a member of Women in Aviation cost me $40 a year or something, and I get the magazine and I make it to some conferences.
I did not know you were a woman.
I found out it's like a lot of things. You don't have to be a woman.
That's right.
To be part of Women in Aviation.
And that's right.
My wife has been very good about making sure that I don't go to too many of the conferences alone. But it is. It's a great resource. You cannot believe how much they give away in scholarships. But I think that's, you know, a point that, you know, as Ravi started, I mean, but it's not easy.
I want to further respond to Phil's suggestion or mentioning of underprivileged, because, you know, it's true. I work on a project in India right now where we're building 28 schools for the poorest of the poor, and we already have one that we've done for 14 years. You know, we take these kids out of the village at the age of four, and we pay for their education through their master's degree. And the program is really designed to eradicate poverty through education and to prove that no matter what the child's socioeconomic background is, he can become a world leader or CEO of a company, and therefore he can become a pilot too. Why not? So, you know, those are the kids that look in the sky and have seen an airplane, but they've never been closer to an airplane. And I think, you know, that whole project started as a philanthropic effort, but my model is to make it a self-sustainable, you know, for-profit model, in fact, in order for it to be self-sustainable. And I think that's what we have to do in the aviation industry to address some of the things that you're talking about. For example, it can start off on a philanthropic level where if somebody were to have a foundation that paid for underprivileged kids to have their flight training, I think that would be great. If EAA Young Eagles reached out directly to the underprivileged as well, you know, more aggressively, then that would open up that opportunity. But ultimately, what I think it's going to take is a business model that's going to come from an airline. And I think, you know, you'll see this happen first in a country like India before it'll happen here, and I'll tell you why. But for a for-profit airline to basically say, we're going to recruit these kids, we're going to pay for their education, and then, like Rob was talking about, we're going to require a certain number of years of service because we've funded their whole education. And the reason why something like this will happen in a country like India first is because you've got 1.2 billion people there. You've got 500 million that are at or below the poverty line. You've got 300 million who are have disposable income. That's another United States already. So what that tells me is that there's a lot of money there, but still the majority of the population that's at or below the poverty line is the real future opportunity, because that's the human infrastructure that the country and the big companies will need to invest in. So it's a great opportunity for all these airlines, you know, small, not so small, but an airline like Indigo Airlines in India that has the largest Airbus order ever, to start training in their own skies. And this is, again, an issue in a country like India or China where the skies are not so open to general aviation yet. So training is an issue. That's another project that I'm working on in India is to have a positive impact on that. But then do the training at home. And then these companies can reach out to the majority of their population and to these young kids. You know, another interesting statistic in a country like India, the median age of the population is 25 years old.
Yeah.
So yeah. You've got a lot of young, poor, but smart and hungry people that can solve, in our industry, can solve some of these concerns about a lack of pilots.
Interesting. Okay, Ravi, this has been a fantastic conversation. Really enjoyed it. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you online? I know you've got a couple of websites.
Well, the place to go, they all basically lead to the same place. It's the raviator.com, which is just the aviator with an R in the middle of it. That'll lead right to my website. And also, just this week, my website went up in French, leraviateur.com as well, because I'm going to start giving my aviation lectures in France starting later this year in French, and a big challenge for me. So that's exciting. You know, the Europe is suffering the same shrinking pilot population issue that we are here. So there's a lot of opportunity to grow the global pilot population.
Ravi, where also can we find your music online, whether just to listen or for purchase?
Yeah, if you go to my website or my music website, which is heyravi.com, H-E-Y, ravi.com, all the links to my music where you can stream and listen and purchase either as a download or a physical copy are there. And, of course, iTunes and Spotify and all the typical online vendors sell my music as well.
All right. You're on Twitter as well?
I'm on Twitter, The Raviator.
There we go.
All right. And Facebook, Ravi The Raviator.
Very good. And we'll put links to all those in the show notes, of course, as we always do. So again, Ravi, fantastic conversation. Really appreciate it. Look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I've enjoyed talking with all of you as well and hope to come back and pick up the conversation some other time.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Hey, thanks for coming on. We really enjoyed it. And you didn't even need that exit strategy.
Nope.
And now with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 4, Episode number 24, August 2nd through the 10th. We're going to skip the daily news and we'll go directly, because it's a little long, to the aircraft of the week. This week's aircraft is the Grumman F-6F Hellcat. When December 7th, 1941, the premier U.S. carrier-based fighter was the portly F-4F Wildcat. The Wildcat was not as agile or as fast as its mortal enemy, but could take far more punishment than the A6M-0. Grumman had already begun a successor to the Wildcat. A contract was written for the F-6F Hellcat. For those who don't know, there was an F-5F. It was a single-seat twin-engine fighter for the U.S. Navy that never went into production. The lessons learned from the F-5F Skyrocket would be used for the F-7F Tiger Cat, but I digress. Originally, the F-6F was to be equipped with Wright R-2600 Cyclone engines with a three-bladed prop. Grumman went and revised the engine specs to make the airframe capable of handling the Pratt & Whitney R-2800 Double Wasp.
Hooray!
The increased, finally, I give you a PW ad and you cheer.
I was right there. I knew where it was going.
The increase in thrust was 25%. The wing was lowered, incorporating main landing gear folding into the wings. This feature improved the landing characteristics of the Hellcat when returning back to the boat. The wings were given the Grumman folding technique, which rotated them back 90 degrees so they folded flat against the fuselage. That wing fold is still used today on the C-2 Greyhound and the E-2D Hawkeye. The armament consisted of 6 50 caliber machine guns with 400 rounds per gun. High-velocity air-launched rockets, or HIVARs, or bombs could also be carried. The first production F-6F3 was flown in October 1942. To show you how quickly production was over 2,500 aircraft were built by the following year. During the Dash-3's production, a 150-gallon drop tank was added and water injection was added to the double WASP, making it the R-2800-10W. Production of the Dash-3 ended in April of 1944. 4,402 of the aircraft were delivered to the United States Navy. Of those, 252 were sent lend-lease to the Royal Navy to be called the Gannet Mark I. Eventually, they were renamed Hellcat Mark I. In September 1943, the Hellcat was bloodied with a pair of Hellcats from the Independence shooting down an Emily flying boat. During the Battle of Tarawa, F-6Fs accounted for 30 zeros for the loss of only one aircraft. The second major variant was the Dash-5. The F-6F-5 had a more streamlined cowl over the water-injected R-2800, providing an additional 200 horsepower. The original rounded wind string was replaced by a flat armored plate glass one. Also, the rear windows behind the cockpit were deleted. The rear fuselage and tail were also strengthened to enhance survivability. The addition armored racks gave the Dash-5 the ability to fire the HIVARs. The Hellcat claimed 5,163 kills, which was over 56% of all U.S. Navy and Marine Corps kills in the Pacific. The Royal Navy flew 1,263 Hellcats and claimed 52 victories with them. The highest scoring U.S. Navy ace was Captain David McCampbell, who received the Medal of Honor, Navy Cross, Silver Star, 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses. All of McCampbell's kills were in Hellcats. By the end of the war, he had 34 kills. On June 19, 1944, he shot down 5 aircraft, making him an ace. On October 24, 1944, during the Battle of the Leyte Gulf, he would shoot down 9 aircraft. For this action, he received the Medal of Honor. His citation reads as thus: "For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity and the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty as commander of Air Group 15 during combat against enemy Japanese aerial forces in the first and second battles of the Philippine Sea, an inspiring leader fighting boldly in the face of terrific odds, Commander McCampbell led his fighter planes against a force of 80 Japanese carrier-based aircraft bearing down on our fleet on June 19, 1944. Striking fiercely in a valiant defense of our surface force, he personally destroyed 7 hostile planes during this single engagement in which the outnumbering attack force was utterly routed and virtually annihilated. During a major fleet engagement with the enemy on October 24th, Commander McCampbell, assisted by only one plane, intercepted and daringly attacked a formation of 60 hostile land-based aircraft approaching our forces. Fighting desperately and with superb skill against such overwhelming power, he shot down 9 Japanese planes, completely disorganizing the enemy group and forced the remainder to abandon the attack before a single aircraft could reach the fleet. His great personal valor and indomitable spirit of aggression under extremely perilous combat conditions reflect the highest credit upon Commander McCampbell's and the United States Navy service." The Hellcat also had 2 sub-variants, the N and the P. The F-6F-5N was a very capable night platform. The P variant carried cameras and provided the fleet with a stable photographic platform for battle damage assessment. The Hellcat would fight again in Korea for the U.S. Navy. The F-6F-5Ks were converted to radio-controlled drones for the Korean War. The 5Ks carried a 2,000-pound bomb and were directed by AD-4 Skyraiders. The aircraft were flown off the U.S. Boxer against bridges. Very successfully, I might add. The French would use them in the Indochina theater of war, read Vietnam, and the last active duty was the Uruguayan Navy, who finally retired to type in 1960. While the Hellcat is accused of being the Wildcat's big brother, it was an entirely new aircraft and dominated the aircraft it was to fight against, the A6M50. Over 11,000 were produced in under 2 years. 305 men achieved A status in the aircraft, and it had a kill ratio of 13 to 1. The Hellcat was one of the weapons that won the war against Japan. So we'll run the randomizer. And next week, we'll go to Japan. The Mitsubishi T2 jet trainer. And that's the way it was. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wow, what an amazing airplane. I mean, that thing's got more history than almost anything else.
It's kind of an unsung hero of the Pacific. It's everybody's kind of attitude is, oh, it's a Hellcat. But
come on, Max, let's be serious.
Yeah.
You were going to say it had even more history than me. I know. You're being nice.
It really did.
And cut this part if it's not relevant, but I had a run out for like 15 seconds. Did you happen to mention that George Bush used to fly Hellcats, I believe. Did he not? Those weren't Hellcats?
No, George Bush flew another Grumman.
He fly Avengers.
He flew Avengers, and they weren't even Grumman. He flew General Motors Trenton-built TBMs, not TBFs. One interesting side note about the Avenger was the reason why General Motors took up production of the Avenger torpedo bomber was because Grumman couldn't keep up with the pace of building Hellcats and Avengers. So they farmed off the Wildcat production and the TBF production. So what you got was FM Wildcats, and you also got TBM Avengers. So General Motors in Trenton was the main producer of both of those aircraft after Grumman designed them and put in production. That was so that Grumman could keep up production with the F-6F Hellcat. So it was a great segue that you could do there, but you were dead wrong, Rob.
All right. Thanks, David.
That was great.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, August 5th, 2012.
Struth, are you okay there, mate?
I can't see a thing here, Steve. It's pitch black in here.
Wow.
Have you turned everything off to avoid the carbon tax or something?
Well, I should do that, mate. I'd save a fortune.
Mate, you'd save a fortune regardless of the carbon tax if you turned everything off in here. But why is it so dark?
Well, it's because exercise pitch black is on at the moment up in Northern Australia, up in the Northern Territory, and all seems to be going well.
Oh, well, yeah, they're having a great time there. Everyone's getting some great photos and hearing some amazing noise and watching as expensive fuel is burned by expensive aircraft, including our new Super Hornets and the Indonesian flankers. And yes, mea culpa, David, you're right. Our esteemed David Vanderhoof was correct that some MiGs had taken part in a Western Air Force event previously, but for the rest of us, this is the first time they've been down here taking part in a military event. So, sorry, David, you were right. I was wrong. And moving along.
Yeah, so it goes for a few more weeks, this exercise. And I will tell you what, some people that we know that live up that way and are flying in and out of there have sent us some wonderful photos and some wonderful reports. So I tell you what, Grant, Darwin's a long way away from us here in Melbourne, but I kind of wish I was up there, actually.
Pretty soon they're about to start doing the night sorties as well. So that may get some good views of aircraft taking off in the dusk. They're generally not taking off at night. It'll probably still be light, but they'll be recovering in the dark.
Absolutely. Well, Grant, speaking of the carbon tax, a bit of a clarification from some coverage that we gave to it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's right, mate. We spoke about the Aerial Agricultural Association of Australia and how they pointed out that thanks to the carbon tax, their prices could be going up as much as $18 per hour. We didn't quite clarify when we were talking about that. A couple of people thought that we were trying to say that was for all of GA aircraft. No, it's specific to the aerial ag guys and their 6 cents per litre increase leading to an $18 per hour increase. That was based on an Airtractor 802F turbine aircraft that burns about 300 litres of AVTUR every hour. And according to them, the 6 cents per litre, they won't be able to be getting exemptions for that. They'll have to be passing that straight on. So that was a bit of a worst case scenario. It wasn't a general GA across the board scenario. So those of you who are flying smaller AV gas aircraft who are wondering how on earth 6 cents a litre adds to $18 per hour, that's how. Burn 300 litres of AVTUR per hour and you too could be paying more.
And yes, Grant, a word of thanks to our listener, Peter, over there, who's based down here at Moorabbin, who sent in quite a lengthy analysis of that $18 an hour and how it might work. And Peter points out to us here in his email, Grant, that he's actually in favour of the carbon tax and thinks that it's sound economic policy. And of course, we respect his right to his view. I just don't happen to agree with it, as you may have noticed, Grant.
Yeah, well, we're going to look at bringing Peter on the show. He's got an economics background, which would be great. It'll be good to have a chat with someone who understands the number crunching, and we can have a chat about where all that's out. But meanwhile, that's a future episode of our show. Back to the Ausdesk. We need to keep moving, mate. And, mate, moving in a really cool kind of way, potentially. We could be totally moved by what may be coming to Melbourne.
Absolutely, mate. The Red Bull Air Race. And I tell you what, we haven't heard of that for a while. In fact, it hasn't been running since 2010. There was some talk that it might come back in 2013, but the latest reports we can find would suggest 2014. And, of course, there is an Australian leg of the Red Bull Air Race from 2006 to 2010. It was held over in the beautiful city of Perth over in Western Australia. But there's a number of East Coast Australian cities that are all competing for the rights to hold it. Should it come back in 2014, Melbourne is one of them. I say bring it on, Grant.
That's right, mate. That's right. The big discussion they're having is apparently they're originally talking about putting it at Geelong around the other side of the bay. But now they're talking about having it at Albert Park. And for once, I actually agree with the Save Albert Park people.
I know,
but not for the right reason. They're just doing it because they hate anything noisy in their beautiful Albert Park area, which, as you've correctly pointed out to me in the past, Steve, was an eyesore until the Grand Prix came along. But I think the big problem is trying to hold it over the lake. The lake's not big enough to be using it as an actual race space. I don't think you can do it looking at safety lines and all that. I think it might be a little bit tight. But have a look at St Kilda Bay, right off the beach. I was down there looking at it on the weekend and contemplating. You could have the temporary airport at Albert Park. Absolutely perfect space for it. Great stretches of turf and also of tarmac that could be used as the runway. And hop, skip, and a splat straight across. You're actually at the beach in seconds when you take off from the park. And it would be perfect. And I'm thinking they've got their wires crossed somewhat. They're talking about Albert Park, but not to have the race over Albert Park, but to base the airport there and to have the race itself happening out over the water.
Yeah, it will be interesting. Albert Park, if they do hold it in Melbourne, and as you point out, Grant, it's right on the beach actually in Port Phillip Bay and St Kilda Pier, and it would be quite picturesque. They do hold the Australian Formula One Grand Prix there. It would be kind of tricky, I think, for them to hold it there. It would be kind of restrictive. I'll tell you what, if they held that race airport granted anywhere else but Albert Park, well, it would make it a nightmare for us to cover, but that's a whole other story.
But, well, you never know. It could wind up going to the Gold Coast, or, you know, what about that beautiful icon of fantastic flight environment, Sydney Harbour. Could you imagine them hosting it in the harbour when you've got the approach departure lanes for Sydney Airport going right over it?
It would be a nightmare, although I would point out that in cities like New York and other places like that, even San Diego, where they've held it, you know, they do seem to be able to work their way around that. Money talks, I guess. I suppose if they were going to hold it, I mean, you know, from a pragmatic standpoint, I think probably holding it up at Sydney with the Harbour Bridge in the background would be far more marketable for them. I kind of feel sorry for Perth, actually. Perth is a beautiful city. And where they have it there on the Swan River, I tell you what, it's just the perfect location. And the race airport is right there. So the only thing I think that goes against Perth, and, you know, the people, our friends over in the West always get very upset when, you know, a lot of the events get pinched from over there and are brought to the East Coast. The only thing that really goes against Perth, I think, is that it's one of the most remote capital cities on Earth. And although it's really only about a 4-hour flight, you know, 4 or 5 hour flight from the East Coast, you still got to do that flight. And it makes it a little bit difficult to attract big crowds. And I think, unfortunately, if they want to make the Red Bull Air Race a more marketable and going concern and have it down here in Australia, then I think they're probably going to have to bring it somewhere over to the East Coast. And, you know, Melbourne, Sydney, or the Gold Coast are all good locations if that happens.
Yeah, we'll see what happens, but just great to hear some Red Bull Air Race news at all, I think.
Now, Grant, let's switch to something else. Technologies. Let's talk about some lasers.
Lasers, yes. As everyone's all aware, Air France AF447 had the big problem because of the ice dome over pitot tubes. That's one of the contributing factors. And a number of aircraft have had problems with blocked or frozen over pitot tubes. And some Australian researchers have come up with a laser-based system that actually lets you figure out your air pressure information, but without actually having to stick a piece of metal out into the airstream.
Yeah, Grant, it says here the laser, which is similar in size to that of a high-end computer mouse, is calibrated to be a specific color of light with a wavelength of 760 nanometers. You know, I sound very intelligent when I talk like that.
Oh, it's great, mate. It's very well read. But as they point out, at that wavelength, a small amount of energy is absorbed by the oxygen in the air. So it's always been pretty hard to try and make this kind of thing work because they could never really get a good enough reading from it, very micro responses. But now what they're looking at is two lasers in opposite directions, gets them a very fine measurement and allows them to measure at those fairly low speeds. They're talking about fairly low speeds in terms of an airliner going at Mach 0.8, but this is because the technologies come from the Scram Space Hypersonic project, where they're traveling a heck of a lot faster.
The sad thing about this is, too, it's often said that it takes a tragedy for technology to take a leap forward like this, and certainly the Air France flight was, you couldn't get much more of a tragedy than that. But if something good can come out of that in the future, well, this sounds like a pretty promising project, actually. I'm quite positive about that. And good to see that Australian industry is leading the way there, which, you know, of course, at the moment, that could be a problem, Grant, because another article we see here in the Australian.com.au says that there may be an aviation skills shortage coming up in Australia.
Oh, that's right, mate. It's all over the world, actually, the skills shortage. A lot of people aren't going into aviation. It's lost a lot of the glamour and the attraction. And honestly, I think a big chunk of it is it costs you so much to become a pilot these days, and you're not getting it paid back. It takes you forever before you're starting to pay back. Whereas, yes, it costs you a lot of hard work and effort and time to become a doctor, but you can pay it back in spades. So it's interesting to see where this one's going, but a lot of awareness. There's a lot of forums and careers expos coming up where they're pushing the whole aviation angle. And the other part of it is that Virgin and SkyWest have started an ab initio cadet scheme with flight training in Adelaide, and they'll offset the cost of your training and your some money towards your accommodation as well. And you just have to sell your soul to them for a number of years. You'll start off as I believe it's a first or second officer on a turboprop. And then after about 1,500 hours, you progress through to the jets.
And there you go, Grant. We've gone a whole Australia desk without talking too much about Qantas or Emirates, which we've been doing constantly the last few weeks. I thought we'd do well.
Oh, I'm very happy about that. There's all sorts of stuff going on in that area. But you know what? It's probably still going to be going on next week.
I think there's some hidden agendas and strategies going on in the background at the moment. It's very interesting to see what's going on here. But we might talk about that next week, Grant.
Yeah, please. Because you know what? We just spoke about Qantas and Emirates. Sorry, folks.
Oh, no. How do we do that?
Oh, we suckered ourselves into it.
No. All right. Well, before we make any more mistakes like that, we'll sign off here. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm still Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
How many people, I wonder, know about Grant's new balloon certificate?
Didn't we mention that?
The part, though, where people take him up in balloons and drop him out, isn't that...
Oh, no, I hadn't heard that part.
No, he got the pilot certificate, not the jump out of the balloon certificate, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, Grant.
Here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I welcome back Frances Peters from Aviation Platform, along with Carmen van Bockel. And we're this week looking at the aviation sector in Luxembourg. Frances, welcome back across the pond.
Thank you for having me on the show again, Peter. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great fan here, so I'm really pleased to be here.
Excellent. Delighted to have you. So let's get on and talk about Luxembourg. Frances, let's start with Cargolux, long-standing Luxembourg airline and probably the most successful. How's it performing these days?
Yeah, it's doing rather well, considering it's a cargo carrier. And at the moment, they're replacing their old 747 fleet with the newer 747-800 freighters.
Yeah.
I believe they're the first to fly the new 747-800. So they're in the test program for Boeing.
Yeah.
And I believe, the first choice to take a cargo carrier, Luxembourg cargo carrier, especially Cargolux, because they have very long routes. So they can profit very well from the lower operating costs that the 747 has.
And what sort of other aircraft are Cargolux running? Are they running predominantly 747s or?
The largest part are 747s, and yep. at the moment they still have some smaller 767s, similar type, narrow body aircraft.
Yeah.
But the largest part of it are the large 747s.
And are they a profitable airline? Are they doing well? Is business work going well for them?
Well, at the moment, the whole of Europe is doing rather bad.
Yeah.
They have more routes to South America, Middle East, and Asia. And those markets are still doing very well. So they have cargo going these regions and, well, more coming back to Europe than from Europe going to those parts of the world. So they are still on the other side of the world in this case.
Right, okay. And as you mentioned, Cargolux were the first operator of the 747-800, the freighter version. Yeah. And as we all know, there were some problems with the financial deal. But how was the aircraft actually performing for them?
Well, it's doing rather good because the problem with the financial deal was that the Gen X engine, General Electric, but I believe the NX2B, was the fuel performance that was written down in the first contract was 2.5 or 7% less than the actual aircraft did.
Right.
So that was a deal breaker, of course, for Cargolux because, if they have a large fleet, 2.7% over all this aircraft, that's a big part of fuel. But at the moment, the General Electric is making a retrofit package for engines, and it will be available in 2013 or the end of 2012. So the fuel performance, won't be an issue anymore.
Yeah.
And currently, they are flying with three or four 747-800 freighters. So I think it's doing rather well.
Right, okay. And what sort of destinations are they serving with the 747s?
As I mentioned, South America, the Middle East, and at the moment they even have a deal because they changed from the majority stake was Luxair, that's the commercial airline in Luxembourg, and Qatar Airways is now also a majority owner of Cargolux. And that's a strategic partnership because Qatar also wants a larger part of the freight market, freight operation, also from the Middle East. So Cargolux more participating on the routes from Brazil, but also from the Middle East, where Qatar has a large network, of course, commercial airlines.
Yeah. And you mentioned Luxair there. Who are the other major airlines operating in and out of Luxembourg?
Well, at the moment, next to Cargo, from Cargolux, you have Luxair with, about 15 aircraft, 60 destinations.
Yeah.
Well, that's the main commercial airline for passengers and business travel. But you also have a few smaller business operators like I believe West Air Luxembourg and Lux Aviation, and they fly with smaller business jets, think Lear jets, those type of aircraft, but no large carrier.
Oh, okay, interesting. And then Carmen, looking at some of their uses of social media, which of these airlines using the social media tools the best?
Well, I must say that all of them are doing their best, as any social media campaign or strategy can be tricky. You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Both Luxair and Cargolux are very visual on Facebook. They post lots of visual posts, which is said that people nowadays are more visual.
Right, okay.
You see that with Instagram, for example.
Yeah.
That's booming at the moment. More people like to see pictures instead of only text.
Yeah.
So I think they're doing great on that.
And so what sort of visual tools are they using? What are the things that are catching the eye?
Well, it's mostly their cover pictures, which are really neat.
Right.
Everybody, you always have to take a risk or a leap in choosing a cover picture. I mean, a person can come onto your page and say, oh, I hate that picture, or wow, awesome picture. But what they also do is every post they put, it's not only text, it's always a video or a picture.
Right.
And that becomes more attractive to people looking on Facebook.
Yeah.
And also the amount of exposure they would have with a picture is bigger than that they would have with only text.
What about things like Twitter and other social media tools?
They're also doing great on that, especially, Cargolux is great on Facebook, but they only have one tweet so far on Twitter, so they're not really active on that.
No, I wouldn't say that.
But Yeah, but they're doing great on Facebook, so I would really like to see them on Twitter.
Yeah.
And Luxair is only in French, and I'm working in French, so it does push me to learn French more, but I think they would have more, yeah, they would have more contact with more people if they would do that in English, for example.
And why are they using social media? Are they looking directly at their customers? Are they trying to build their brand? What is it that they're using it for?
And well, in the beginning, social media was usually used for as a customer service end.
Yeah.
To see, okay, if somebody lost their baggage, it would be a quicker way through Twitter or Facebook to get a response instead of calling. And then they would have to say, hold on a minute or a few seconds before we can get the right person to help you. And with Twitter and Facebook, they have a whole team and that goes a lot quicker. But now, like, for example, KLM, they use social media to increase brand engagement, strengthen their reputation, but ultimately for commerce to sell more tickets. That's their ultimate goal. That's what they want to use for.
Yes, and we want to see all these airlines doing better, particularly in Europe, which is struggling. Well, thank you very much for joining us on this Bravo Benelux update. Frances, where can we find you online?
Well, of course, on our website, that's www.aviationplatform.com, or follow us at Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter. So we have all social media covered and we have a nice website.
It certainly is. And Carmen, can we follow you on Twitter or anywhere like that?
I'm crazy about social media, so you can always follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and of course, aviationplatform.com.
Okay. Carmen, Frances, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. And well, hope to you next time.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Glad to have you back online. All right, we're going to close it here. We ran a little bit long with our conversation with Ravi, but I think that was very much worthwhile. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as we did. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Especially want to thank our guest, Ravi. You can find him at www.theraviator.com. And his link for his music is heyravi.com, H-E-Y-R-A-V-I.com. On Twitter, he's The Raviator. Also look for his Facebook page, YouTube page. He actually does have a page for his Air Venturous piece. That's at airventurous.com.
Can I just ask one question before we go?
Sure, Rob.
What would you guys think if I started calling myself The Raviator?
The Raviator.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just made that up.
Please don't.
Oh, okay.
I think that's great.
See? Phil knows his stuff.
Yeah, he does.
Durner, you bucking to try to come back?
I was trying to be slightly dry and sarcastic in saying that.
I was going
to
say, you know, Rob appreciates a brown nose here and there. Of
course. Flattery will get you everywhere.
That's right.
We want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Fisher from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson, who you can find at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. And you can also listen to his aviation podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E in extended. All right. We want to thank you, Phil, for joining us for this episode. Why don't you tell folks where they can find you online?
You can always come to nycaviation.com for day-to-day news, breaking news, and all kinds of plane spotting information for enthusiasts and industry professionals.
Yeah, it's a great site, too. Well done.
Thank you.
And have you noticed that nobody's, at least I haven't seen anybody try to copy you. I haven't seen an Atlanta aviation necessarily or Chicago aviation or I think you scared them all away.
I think that's because they cover just about everything besides NY.
Okay, I guess.
Honestly, the NYC kind of is just a name these days, and we like to think that we cover the country and the world.
Yeah.
We actually do also own many domain names with other major city initials with the word aviation in it already.
Aha.
So bring it. We'll compete against ourselves.
Go, just try it, baby. Yeah.
And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog at What Just Flew By. And you can find me lurking around the Whitman Airport Facebook page at Facebook/Whitman Airport.
Okay.
Lots of pictures for Oshkosh 12, folks.
Yes, nice stuff, too. And Rob Mark, yes, where do people find you online?
Well, let's see. Now that I'm back from having been stuck at LaGuardia, oh, we already went through that whole thing, didn't we? That's right.
Yeah, let's pretend we did.
Well, that was a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Anyway, seriously, you can find us at jetwine.com, at Jetwine on Twitter, Jetwine on Facebook. I hang out at the Whitman Airport Facebook page with David sometimes. I don't know, other places that I've been known to get into a little bit of trouble occasionally.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also, look for me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 209. They'll contain links to all the sites we mentioned in the podcast. And be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook and also Google Plus. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Benay Wilson has that number for you.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thanks, Benay. Opening music is by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. Closing music, I think we'll do Air Adventurous, which is what you're listening to right now. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening.
Take care, everyone.
That's what it means to be adventurous. Now all grown up, stick in the hand. A life in the sky, not just a dream on the land. The world he sees from the sky above, it's changed his life, how he thinks, what he does. Yet there's always more to explore. What lies ahead, what came before? There's only one place with it all. Come on, let's go. Here on the ground, just look around, surrounded by a field of dreams. Up in the sky, look at the five magical mystery machines. It's everything you want it to be, gonna blow your mind. That's what it means to be adventurous.
The Airplane Geeks podcast is sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn to fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight.
No, that actually might be a lot of fun. I don't mean fun in the sense of haha, but I'm saying it might be a really interesting show.
You might kill each other by the time that's over.
My coal-powered computer.
Yes. That's right.
I have four children under my desk shoveling coal into my tower.
Okay. And somebody has to play devil's advocate.
I know. You play the role well, David.
Listen, I wish I could disagree with you on some of what you said, David. I can't. And that's the problem, is that I think a lot of us feel like we can see both sides, but legislators don't seem to be able to.
Again, our guest this episode.
Let's play some music. I want to hear some music.
We will. Just a second. Okay. All right. So.
And next week, we'll go to Japan. The Mitsubishi T2 jet trainer.
And that's the way it was.
Oh, geez, I forgot the closing. And that's the way it was. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Your air pressure information, but without actually having to stick a piece of metal out into the airstream. You're still reading the article, aren't you?
I am.
Go me. I could pick it.
Yeah, Grant, it says here the laser, which is...
I'm hearing you dropping in and out a bit, by the way.
That's all right. Yeah, you got a good stream this morning, so.
That's what the doctor said.
Yeah. Should I put headphones on?
Yeah. Yeah. Could you put could you plug headphones in?
It doesn't matter if they're from the 60s, so we don't see them.
And as Frenchess knows, it's normally me that makes the mistakes, so don't worry if anything. Yeah, we do have rather large number of outtakes at the end of the main program, so and most of them are the presenters, so I that was my fault and I should make better.